pianist Angela Hewitt in the Fantasia in C minor, BWV 906 by J.S. Bach. And we've just time for one more brief piece of Bach from her. This is one of his two-part inventions. Part of the invention number one in C major played there by Bach, and it was played there by Angela Hewitt, and I do apologise for losing the beginning of that.
The Edinburgh Festivals 2013, on radio, on TV and online throughout August on the BBC. And on BBC Radio 3, daily Queen's Hall recitals from the Edinburgh International Festival itself.
One of Edinburgh's loveliest music venues.
3 weeks of amazing music making for mid-morning festival goers.
Coffee, a croissant and a concert the order of the day.
Music from Edinburgh favourites and from stars of the future. Weekday mornings with Jamie McDougall, Marianne Kennedy and, to start the season, Donald MacLeod.
Greek string quartet, as I imagine, you've never heard it before. I know I never have.
The Edinburgh International Festival on BBC Radio 3. Weekday mornings next week at 11 o'clock.
BBC Radio 3, it's 20 to 9. And time now for Proms Plus, recorded earlier this evening at London's Royal College of Music. In the chair is James Jolly.
Welcome to this Proms Plus event, Mahler and Spirituality, and I'm joined by Norman Lebrecht and Jeremy Barham. Jeremy Barham is Reader in Music at the University of Surrey. His PhD thesis was on Mahler's Third Symphony and its relationship to 19th century philosophy and culture. He's published many essays on Mahler, and a collection of essays, Rethinking Mahler, is due out next year. Norman Lebrecht, no stranger to Radio 3 audiences, thanks to his interviews with the music's great and good, is a cultural commentator, novelist and author of Mahler Remembered, and most recently, Why Mahler. Being a little bit flippant, I was thinking we could perhaps subtitle this talk, Four Funerals and a Wedding. And I want to start actually at a funeral and take us back to February the 19th, 1889, to the Jewish cemetery in Jihlava, or Iglau as it's known in Germany. Norman, maybe you could sort of paint the picture.
Mahler's father has died. He is, at the time, music director of the opera in Budapest. He's 28 years old, very, very young to be music director of the second biggest opera house in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And with his great sense of family responsibility, he goes back to his hometown for his father's death. And it's quite a shattering experience for him. Because he stays there for a week, from which we can deduce that he observed the Jewish week of mourning, the ritual of sitting in the house on low chairs and people coming to pay their sympathies. And we can also deduce that he said Kaddish, the memorial prayer at his father's grave. We don't know it for certain, but what seems probable is that this was the last time that Mahler took part in Jewish observances, because when his mother died a few months later, he didn't go. And this is a great paradox, because Mahler was close to his mother. His mother meant everything to him. When he was a child, his most traumatic experiences were when she had headaches and he would hide behind her chair and pray for her to be cured. When she was slightly disabled, when she was having marital tiffs with his father and they got quite violent, Mahler always took his mother's side. So to have gone to the funeral of the father whom he respected but did not love, and not to have gone to the funeral of the mother whom he loved but could not protect, is one of those key paradoxes in Mahler's development.
Now, death was ever present in life back then. I mean, he lost a huge number of siblings. I mean, it must have been a very traumatic childhood.
Yeah, I mean, as Marlowe grew up, he saw a number of his siblings die, some at a very young age, some a little bit later. I think at least six of his siblings died in infancy or in young childhood. And, of course, later in the 1890s, in 1895, his brother committed suicide. He was living in Vienna at the time. And Mahler was supporting him and essentially his mentor. He was a musician as well, Otto Mahler. So, yes, death surrounded Mahler's life from a very young age. And that kind of experience, I think, is you can hear and see and feel very clearly in his compositional output. Indeed, the symphony we're talking about tonight, I think, is one of several of his symphonies that tries to address death and the experience of it and how to deal with it, how to move on, how to come to terms with personal, individual loss. And it's also a kind of spiritual exploration of the meaning of life and the inevitability of death. So yes, death does rear its head throughout Mahler's life, both in a personal and family context and in a creative context.
Now, in sort of musical terms, there are a number of funeral marches throughout his music, and they're often sort of mingling with other sounds. I mean, he was brought up basically over a tavern, mm-hmm. so as the children's bodies would have been removed from the house, there would have been the sound of sort of carousing.
That's the first symphony. That's where when you hear in the third movement of the first symphony, you hear a children's lullaby, which we know as Ferozhaka, being transformed into the minor, and then into what sounds like a funeral march. There's this, the tread of the double basses. And what Mahler is doing is he's telling you, he's writing about the death of children. It then turns into this wild Bacchanalian dance, and you realize that he's giving you simple autobiography. He's grown up above a tavern. Six of his brothers and sisters died in infancy. There was very little respect given in those days to the death of a young child. There were just formalities. And as the coffin left the house by the back door, the singing and dancing went on in the tavern down below. And Mahler, in the First Symphony, is actually addressing one of the acute social issues of that time and of our time and saying, what is the value that we put on the life of a child? So from the very beginning, he is socially engaged. He is also autobiographically engaged, and he's doing exactly as Freud does in his work. He's extrapolating an incident from his own childhood in order to try and build some larger theory, some larger question that we can all contemplate. When Mahler says to Sibelius, much later, they're going for a walk in the woods, and Sibelius has finished his third symphony. He's feeling very pleased with himself, and he says to Mahler, isn't the symphony a wonderful thing? You can achieve absolute formal and notational perfection. There's not a single superfluous note in my work. And Mahler says, rubbish. The symphony is like the world. It must embrace everything. What he means is it cannot be detached as a piece of formal perfection. It actually has to grapple with the issues that matter to us day in, day out, in our daily lives, in our public lives, in our political lives. That's what he does in the First Symphony. At the end of the First Symphony, there is a sense of something or someone dying, that the hero has died. If you've killed off your hero in the First Symphony, what on earth are you going to do in the Second?
Jeremy, maybe you'd like to pick up that. I mean, we had a funeral march in Beethoven's Eroica, but that was a kind of different thing. I mean, as Norman's left us at the brink of Symphony No. 2.
Well, this idea of the symphony embracing the world, I think, is particularly pertinent with, it's all of Mahler's symphonies, but particularly with the second. And in addition to being surrounded by funeral marches and death and so on during his childhood and formative years, he was also surrounded by a whole host of other types of music. In Iglau, for instance, where he grew up, there was a very strong tradition of what were called Fiedlerkapellen, or fiddle bands, who would perform at all sorts of occasions. including funerals, but also processions, wedding processions, farmers' processions. In fact, there was an annual tradition in Iglau, which was called the Procession of the Miner's Pick. And this was a celebration of the miners who played a huge part in the town. All of these occasions would have been accompanied by music of one sort or another. Then there's also the folk music that Mahler would have heard in and around the vicinity of Iglau. There are accounts from this period in the 1870s, 1880s, of him walking around the countryside with friends and coming across a band or a group of dancers. And it's interesting to contemplate or speculate what his response as a sort of budding musician was to that kind of music which pervaded his environment, or that a whole range of music. So in the Second Symphony, I mean, obviously the funeral march topic is something which pervades the work hugely, and it underlines the meaning of the work, I think, to a huge extent. But the second movement of the symphony often gets forgotten. Because the first movement's so cataclysmic, the finale is so overwhelming, the scherzo is so striking in its humour, the poor old second movement tends to get neglected. And the second movement is a very delicate kind of minuet, Lendler type of music in a 3/4 metre. It's dance music. So I think that's an example, in combination with all the plethora of other techniques and musical languages and ideas that are in the symphony. This is an example of Mahler's dictum that the symphony should embrace the world. So you've got death, you've got a gentle minuet, you've got almost operatic elements in the work, you've got the very unusual use of physical space in the symphony, which exploits kind of sense of distance and depth. All of this combines to create the Mahlerian symphony, and the Second Symphony is the epitome of that kind of breadth of experience that he wants to communicate or represent somehow in his symphonies.
And while Mahler was, as a young man, going around absorbing all this different sort of music, I mean, what was his sort of spiritual life? What sort of family were they? Were they an observant family?
They were observant. They were, if you ask, what is Mahler doing growing up in Jihlavy? When he was 3 months old, his parents had a little business in a village, and they moved from the village into the town. Why did they do that? Because it had become permissible for them to do it. Until that time, Jews were not allowed to live in a garrison town like Iglau. They were only allowed to enter it by the day, and they had to be gone by 7 p.m. at night. The moment it became possible for them to do that, his parents, with a three-month-old baby, moved, just sold the business, moved into town, started again, started a community, were involved in the community, involved in the purchase of a cemetery and the building of a synagogue. The father was the chairman of the synagogue education committee, so they were very much engaged as traditional Jews. The extent of their observance, his mother lit candles on Friday night, they probably kept a kosher home, and I'm speculating here, but it's fairly probable that the lingua franca between the parents, at least when they didn't want the children to understand, was Yiddish. Mahler always said that he'd only spoken Hochdeutsch, perfect German, but I think that's quite unlikely. So that's the extent of their Jewishness. He certainly has a bar mitzvah when he's 13. And I think when he's 15 and he goes to Vienna to the conservatory, a terribly young age to leave home and to go into the big city for the first time, he's only been there once before for interview, at that point he starts to separate from his Jewish observances and to look for a place for himself within the wider society and to read voraciously. He's a huge reader of poetry and of philosophy, and his search for the meaning of life is done more through German literature than through the Bible, but he knows the biblical texts and he certainly knows Jewish traditions, and these start to inform what is going to become his Resurrection Symphony.
Resurrection, you know, to a lot of in a Christian country would be considered a Christian term. I mean, where does the concept of resurrection sit in the Jewish faith?
Well, it's an incredibly bold thing of Mahler as a Jewish musician who suffers onslaughts of anti-Semitism in his job at Budapest, somewhat less when he goes to Hamburg as conductor of the opera. But he's very much faced with his position as a minority and as a loathed minority in Budapest. It's extremely bold of him to take what most people would imagine was a piece of Christian Catholic dogma and make a symphony of it. And of course, Mahler doesn't see it that way because he doesn't see the resurrection as being Christian at all. He knows it as a prayer that Jews say three times a day in their observances, in which they ask God for the resurrection of the dead. But the resurrection in Judaism, unlike Christianity, is non-judgmental. It's not the righteous who will arise and the sinners who will stay down wherever they are. Everyone has a right to resurrection. And Mahler, in the text of the Second Symphony, and in his utterances about the Second Symphony, confirms this. Everybody is going to have a second chance. So this is a challenge to Christian dogma. And there were a couple of commentators at the first performance of the Second Symphony who said, this is, you know, bloody cheek. You know, who does this fellow think he is? This is, the musicians shouldn't be writing about resurrections, least of all a Jewish musician. This is a matter for bishops.
Now, in February 1897, I mean, Mahler made the biggest jump in his career. He went to become artistic director of the Vienna Court Opera, which would be later the Vienna State Opera, possibly the most important musical job in Europe. He had to convert, or it was expedient to convert to Roman Catholicism. I mean, what do you think was going on behind that?
It's difficult to be totally certain about this, but that it was merely a change of coat, as Mahler said. I've just changed my coat, I'm still the same. And it was a matter of expediency. It was the only way he would be able to get the job in the current sort of socio-political situation of Vienna at the end of the 19th century.
It was a legal thing as well, Jeremy.
Yes,
you couldn't
yes.
be an official at the court opera without subscribing to the yeah. court religion.
And he wasn't alone. Hundreds of thousands of Jews converted to Christianity in order to further assimilate themselves as they saw it and as it was seen by wider society, and to gain positions of authority in whatever field they worked. So he certainly wasn't alone. And some of his closest friends did the same thing. So in a sense, on one level, it was a total expediency and, as Norman said, a legal matter. I wouldn't discount the kind of obverse of that, which is that Mahler did have an interest in the Catholic faith. He had an interest in all sorts of spiritual ideas. So, yes, resurrection to him, I think, was something that was not particularly dogmatic in nature. Mahler never subscribed or wanted to feel, I think, limited by any particular dogma or narrow vision of spirituality or religious observance, which is why I think he looked, as Norman said earlier, to a whole range of literature to also find solutions or answers to the pressing questions that bothered him, most especially about spirituality and the nature of existence. One example that comes to mind is Dostoevsky. He was a passionate admirer of Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov novel. There's a quote at the beginning of the novel, which is a biblical quote, and it's the famous, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone, but if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit." Dostoevsky described The Brothers Karamazov as a novel about atheism. And what he meant by that was a novel that explored the nature of religious belief. That's the theme, and the characters within the novel obviously reflect different sides of that argument and that exploration. Mahler was very taken by this novel and the seriousness with which it explored these issues. And that motto, I think, reminds me very, very strongly, of course, of what the text at the end of the Second Symphony says. In order to live again, something has to die. So it's, again, with this symphony, it is dealing with, finding ways of dealing with tragedy, with loss, with the idea of death, and exploring solutions to how we can, as human beings, I think, cope with that situation, which is obviously a kind of universal concern. And Mahler used lots of different musical means to explore that and hopefully arrive at least an interim conclusion. I think, actually, it took several further symphonies for him to get further along the line of answering the question. The Third Symphony is yet another way of looking at that at these deep questions, that goes down the route more of pantheistic ideas and achieving a sort of oneness with nature. I think that's quite different from the Second Symphony, which is in turn quite different from the First Symphony. So the first few symphonies are definitely exploring these issues from different perspectives. And I think he gets these different perspectives from his experience of his spiritual upbringing, from his huge interest in philosophy and literature. One might mention Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, and also a little known German philosopher called Fechner, who explored exactly the same or very similar ideas, the ideas of life after death. Is there existence after death? If so, what, you know, what form does that take? So there's a whole panoply of ideas that come to play in Mahler's creative process. And the Second Symphony is offering, I think, one perspective. It's a huge perspective, but it's one perspective amongst others that appear in his early symphonies.
He doesn't want it to be a Christian resurrection. He doesn't want it to be a Jewish resurrection. He wants it to be a universal, creed-free resurrection. He wants it to be a way for the whole of humanity to look at the meaning of life and death and to try to come to terms with the purpose of life on earth and with how we cope with bereavement and how we cope with renewal. And that is something of what he's trying to tell us in this work.
Thank you very much. Norman de Brecht, Jeremy Barham, thank you. And thank you.
James Jolly there with tonight's Proms Plus intro, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music in London. And just a reminder, you can hear tonight's prom of Mahler's Second Symphony online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for the next 7 days. Or you can hear it on air here on BBC Radio 3 on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
It's about sharing the music that we both love and putting them together.
There really has never been a gig like this, I think, because there'll be fans of both sorts of music, from classical music to some of the artists we play on Six Music, and I think we're all in for a surprise. I'm Steve Lamacq.
And I'm Tom Service.
We may come from different ends of the radio dial, but Radio 3 and Radio 6 Music share a common passion, music.
Join us live on both stations for the Six Music Prom. We'll have live music from the Stranglers, Laura Marling and Kerris Matthews, all performing with the London Sinfonietta.
Six Music and Radio 3 present the Six Music Prom.
Monday night on BBC Radio 3 at 10:15.
BBC Radio 3, well, Wednesday evening saw the culmination of the BBC Prom's Inspire Young Composers competition with a concert of the winning entries. Here's Andrew McGregor.
Some of the nation's brightest young composers, aged 12 to 18, are here at the Royal College of Music in London, exploring their musical boundaries and finding out for themselves what it might mean to be a 21st century composer. It's the 15th year of the BBC Proms Inspire Young Composers competition, which offers a world-class platform with which to reach an audience. This year there were 150 entries. Five young composers have won a performance at the BBC Proms, a broadcast here on BBC Radio 3, and a much-coveted BBC commission. Now, there are composition workshops as well to help some of our young composers explore musical possibilities, and not least the chance for the winners to have their music rehearsed and performed by the Aurora Orchestra and its conductor Nicholas Collin. I caught up with him earlier to ask whether he was impressed by the standard of entries this year.
Well, I've been involved with this. I think this is my sixth year. And every year, I have to say, I'm astounded by the level of writing. It really is extraordinary to think that everyone involved in the competition is under the age of 18. It's surprising, I have to say, but very, very encouraging for the future of music in this country.
And did you see quite a big division between the 13-year-olds and the 18-year-olds? You'd expect to see a degree more experience and maturity.
You see a difference probably in style more than anything, but a 13-year-old can still write with incredible enthusiasm and joy of music. And in fact, there is one 13-year-old in this group, and his piece is very, very accomplished and joyful and beautifully written.
Real imagination as well for some
absolutely.
Of the younger ones.
Exactly, yeah. And the imagination comes at all stages of youth, I guess.
And what about the ensemble itself? Because the Aurora is a very young ensemble. It must help quite a bit when it comes to actually interacting with the composers and performing their music.
I think it's probably nice for them. I think it's nice for the young composers that they are working with players who are, although we're not of the same generation, they're probably the next generation. So they get to sort of understand us a little bit more, perhaps, and empathise with us and vice versa.
What about your role as a conductor? Because such an important part of this whole event and this process is the way in which you're able to work with the composers themselves.
I think for a lot of them it's potentially, I don't know, but it might be a slightly daunting experience hearing their pieces played by a professional ensemble. So I suppose as a conductor you also have to try and sort of broach that conversation between the players and young composers and make them feel at home and comfortable, and also occasionally try and point out things that could be done in a more efficient or easy to read or more fruitful way, and try and sort of encourage them as much as possible.
Nicholas Collin, conductor of the Proms Inspire Young Composers Competition. And the first piece we're going to hear from the winner's concert is by Thomas Brown. He's one of the winners from the senior category for 17 to 18-year-olds. And I asked him about his piece, Recomposed Baroque.
Thomas Brown, I'm 18 years old, and I was currently at Cheetham School of Music, which I've just left, and in September I'll be beginning composition studies at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland.
Now, Thomas, you've been composing for some time from the sound of it. When did you start? What actually got you started?
I was just doing little bits and pieces when I was younger, and then I first started composing a bit more seriously when I was at secondary school, probably around the age of 12, 13, something like that.
When it came to the competition for this Inspire Day, what did you have in mind? Did you have an idea that you already wanted to get out on paper, or did you just come up with something specially for this occasion?
Well, I'd already had a piece that was written before that. The piece is inspired by Max Richter, because he wrote the Vivaldi Four Seasons Recomposed. So it's inspired by that, really. And it was just a piece that I thought would be suitable for this competition. It's quite different, which is what they were looking for.
You've called it Recomposed Baroque. Are there recognisable quotations? And why have you chosen particular composers or snippets of music for it?
Well, I chose quite recognisable pieces. I chose the Badinerie and Polonaise and the Double from Bach's Orchestral Suite No. 2. Then there's other times where it's not as recognisable, such as with the Handel quotation that I used from The Messiah, and I've also used bits from a lesser-known composer called Bieber, who did a bit of work with polytonality and some extended techniques, which I've used on the cello.
So when you've recomposed these pieces of Baroque music like this, what have they become? How would you describe the overall result, the finished article?
It takes you through a lot of things. The opening's quite minimalist, actually. And then after that, it brings in a big Bach quotation, actually, from the Badinerie. And then after that, it kind of goes through a few different themes, and then suddenly it's quite slow before it builds up again, which you'll hear in the piece.
I think we're going to hear it straight away. Recomposed Baroque by Thomas Brown. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bach, Bieber and Handel amongst the composers recomposed by 18-year-old Thomas Brown. That was his piece, Recomposed Baroque. And the next work we're going to hear is by Lucinda Rimmer. She's one of the winners in the junior category for 12 to 16-year-old composers. She's called her piece Sunset Dance at Mencora.
The initial idea was based around the GCSE music brief, which was a piece of world music or inspired by another culture. So I did some research looking at music from all kinds of different cultures, and I got quite interested in the ideas that we have about Egyptian music, because we don't actually know for sure what ancient Egyptian music sounded like, and this is my take on what I think it might have been like.
So as you say, we don't actually know how ancient Egyptian instruments sounded. Have you had to be creative and come up with sounds that perhaps the members of the Aurora Orchestra won't normally have made on their instruments?
I've used the oboe and the flute to recreate, again, the reedy sound from the oboe and the more windy sound of primitive flutes, along with the use of a drone, which would normally be maybe a drum or some kind of string instrument in the piano.
And how does the piece actually work? Is it a celebration of Egyptian culture? What's the scenario that you're putting in front of us?
It's supposed to be a dance, as the title kind of says, celebrating the god Menkaure, well, Pharaoh Menkaure, who is supposed to have turned night into day, which is why it is sunset dance at Menkaure, in order to live longer.
Well, let's hear it. Lucinda, thank you very much indeed. We're going to hear Sunset Dance at Menkaure by Lucinda Rimmer.
Thank you.